Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hope that you have enjoyed the conference so far today. If you had to rate the conference on a scale from thumbs up, hand in the middle, thumbs down, what would you give it so far today? Okay, excellent. Fantastic. Me too. I'm so glad that you've joined this afternoon session on caring for our nation's veterans. We have some wonderful speakers, and we're going to begin with Doug and Bea Miller. Or is Bea here? Oh, Bea is here. I didn't see you back there, Bea. Okay, so Doug and Bea Miller are here. I'd love to introduce them for you. They are both semi-retired from the real estate industry, and they are the part of the congregation here at Christ Church of Grove Farm. As longtime supporters of our country's veterans, they write that we learned of a national organization working with severely wounded veterans from September 11, 2001 and forward while attending a real estate convention. Working with and through that organization, we were able to establish our own local support group. Christ Church at Grove Farm welcomed our ideas with open arms, giving us the ability to create an outreach ministry, thereby helping just a few of our veterans and their families who have sacrificed so much for us. If each area church can only help one, what a great contribution we could all make together. So let's welcome Doug and Bea Miller.
I didn't know if she was coming up here or not. Are you coming? You're not. I have to preface this by saying, when I get in front of more than five or six people, I do auctions, and I just want to stand up and sell something quick. But my wife is the organized person. I am not real organized. How organized I am, if you look at the sheet, you'll see that Shane and Cochise were to come. Shane is one of our sentinels. Cochise is a service dog that we were able to help him get. I came prepared. I have a meal for Cochise. I've got a watering dish for Cochise. And as things happen, they're not here. Since we've been involved in this ministry, it comes over and over and over again. It's PTSD, TBI, things that we're just not aware of. We were asked to, or given the opportunity to present a 10 to 15 minute orientation about the Sentinels, of which my wife sat there and she wrote me out a 15-minute speech, and she edited it all, and she did her 5-minute speech, and we were going to give the balance of it to Shane. Shane was to meet us at 8 o'clock with Cochise. Shane was to email us back. Okay, and I can tell you I know exactly what happened. Okay, he woke up this morning and could not face the world. This is one of the reasons that we got involved with Shane and were able to help him purchase a service dog, which I'll get into a little bit later. But I want to take my 10, my 12, my 15-minute speech that I was supposed to give. And like I say, I was so organized. I had my dog biscuits. I had my pan. I had absolutely everything. Everything I needed except Shane and Cochise. So, overwhelmed listening to Shane this morning. I took my speech and I ripped it up and I said, you know what, I'm going to do an impromptu. I'm just going to make it up as I go along. It just fits the situation. Everything I planned on didn't work. And the notes that I took, and I think the first thing that Shane said that I jotted down right away was, we have no idea what is happening unless we have been in those shoes. So I wrote that down and said, you know, I want to build a little bit around that. But before I do that, I want to give you just a very, very quick history on how this whole thing came about with our church. My wife and I were at a real estate convention in Atlanta, Georgia. At that time, I was a real estate agent with Remax Real Estate. The owner and the founder of Remax, Dave Leninger, had met a young fella out in California who had started a organization called Sentinels of Freedom. And he had gotten involved with them. He had three sons that were Rangers. At that time, between the three, they had done 18 deployments, a career service family. So one of their very best friends was severely injured. One thing led to another. Dave met Mike Conklin, who was the founder of Sentinels. Mike came to the convention with a sentinel. It was a young fella who had lost both of his legs in an explosion. He was able to go through the Sentinels program, became a very, very successful banker. But this man walked out on stage, and I'm talking from, this is in a room full of 10,000 people, came across the stage unassisted, on his, just totally unassisted, stood there and gave a 15-minute speech with no help, no support. Obviously, the majority of the real estate agents in the room had tears in their eyes. A very, very moving moment. To which we walked outside, and my wife says, "We're getting involved." I said, "No." She said, "We are going to get involved with this group called Sentinels of Freedom." I said, "Absolutely not." She said, "Yes, we are." So I put my foot down, and I said, "No." To which my wife said to me, "We are going back to the room, and we are going to pray about this." And I said, "Well, you go back to the room, you pray about it, I'm going out with the guys. Period." She said, "God will send us a sign." I said, "No, I don't think so." We go to leave Atlanta, Georgia, where the convention was. We are in the airport. This was 2 to 3 weeks before Easter, 9, 10 years ago. At that time, the Methodist had, they were promoting the Easter season with these huge banners. It said, "Are you looking for a sign?" Well, there happened to be one of these huge, huge signs in the Atlanta airport. Says, "Are you looking for a sign?" We saw the sign. We look below the sign, and there is a priest talking to a returning soldier dressed out in his BDUs. My wife said. So 3 weeks later, we were on a plane. We were on our way to Denver, Colorado, to train for this. At that time, there were 50-some organizations, different real estate agents or brokers, et cetera. We set up these Sentinels of Freedom in these individual cities. B and I were probably one of the very few agents there. Most of them were brokers or lawyers for the big firms and real estate firms and that, and had access to a great deal of money. We did not. We came back and presented it to our church and said, "It's just something that we want to do, is we want to work with wounded soldiers, 9/11, going forward." The church gave us their blessing, gave us a place to meet. We started with either a $10 check or a $100 check. It was one of the two. And things just developed. God just opened so many doors. I just ran into a fella just who knew a guy that knew a guy that knew a guy, and they gave us some seed money to start. While we were sitting in this gentleman's office, he said, "You know what?" He said, this is something that needs done. Picks his phone up, calls his attorney on the phone. He said, "There's a young couple I'm talking." He didn't say young, did he? He said, "There was a young woman and an old guy here that I've been chit-chatting with." He says, "I want you to set up a 501(c) pro bono," which they did. And so we became Sentinels of Freedom, Western Pennsylvania. We had our own 501 and were divorced from the parent organization in California. We had our own board of directors. We had our own members. We made up our own decisions. And I can tell you story after story of some of the things that we got involved in. And I will tell you this, many, many, many blessings, many, many heartaches. You'll run into things that just are tear-jerkers. About the first of the year, the Sentinels of Freedom was kind of patterned after Wounded Warriors, where the Wounded Warriors were doing as much as they could for as many. We were set up where we would key in on the needs of one individual and just try to, whether it was financial, one of our members happened to be a retired mathematics professor. He would tutor the someone. We had financial advisors. We had everything all set up. Everything that we did, absolutely everything, was on a volunteer basis. When the news articles started really coming out the first of the year about some of these 501(c)s, well, not all of the money was making it back to where it should have been. And this kind of happened with the Sentinels. They the parent organization was in California. They had absorbed all of these 50-some little groups that we had around the country. All but four of us they had absorbed. And two of them eventually did get absorbed. And we were one of the ones that offer was for us to send all of our funds out there, and they would control the funds to come back. So what we did, we said, you know, we want to keep the money local. We are very, very proud that we have never spent any money other than to go to the benefit, whether it was just $14.95 to send a package to a vet, or whether it was picking a tab up for 24 months of rent so that particular vet could bank his housing allowance. But anyway, we decided to come back under the umbrella of the church, again, to eliminate the possibility of any expense. So that's pretty much the history behind us. Like I say, we've had several opportunities to serve people that will bring tears to your eyes. On the other hand, we've had some things that you see goes back to what Shane was talking about, until you have walked in their shoes. So what I wanted to do was, before B does her few moments here, I wanted to tell you this. If it can be done with very, very little money. If you have a smaller church that you don't think you have quite enough staff, we would welcome the opportunity for you to come and join us here. We meet once a month. Everything that we do is wide open. Our books are wide open to anybody that comes to our meetings. On the other hand, if you have a church that wants to get involved on your own, B or I, either one of us or both, would be more than happy to come and speak with you. But again, I think when we stop and realize how much these young men and these young women have given, we should be back to serve.
Are you all done?
I am.
Basically, we're here to encourage you to form a military ministry or mission in your own church. And part of the reason is because of the funding and the lack of overhead and expenses. We can pretty much give 100% back to the veterans that we're serving of the funds that we're raising. And it also gives your congregation, you can have a small group to begin with, but if there is a specific need, your congregation will be right behind you in building those funds for that particular need. Whenever I passed out some of the sheets it gave you a sample of our meeting agenda. And one of our brochures for the moment, and the brochure has two of the young fellows that we were able to help. One is a double amputee, and the other fellow was going to be here today, as Doug said. He has PTSD and TBI, and we were able to help him. He was fundraising, trying to raise enough money to get a service dog because of his PTSD and his TBI. He has shrapnel still left in his body. But he was getting little bits here and there. A service dog costs, his service dog costs $17,000. And that's a lot of money for any one organization to come up with. So as he was raising funds, we told him that once he went through all of the organizations that were willing to help, then we would fund the rest to make sure he got the dog. So he did get the dog. The dog and he are doing exceptionally well. He's not here, however, because we're guessing because of the PTSD. There are days he gets up and he cannot be out in a crowd. He does have a job and he's got two young boys and he's very involved in their lives. But there are so many different injuries and wounds. A lot of them are visible. They are coming back a lot of times now because of the medical advances that have been made. They're wearing the armor, the body armor, and so they're coming back alive, which is good. But many times they're coming back without limbs. And so those injuries are visible. The others are PTSD, and I think possibly the VA and the rest of us are just learning what that means and how much help they actually do need. I think at first it was something more like, it's just mental, get over it. And I think that Father Morris will give us some more information on that. And the moral well-being of these folks. And having a faith-based organization kind of puts together the physical needs, the emotional needs, and the spiritual needs. So if any of you are wanting to go back to your churches and start an organization, it's not difficult. The churches, I'm sure, yes. Yes, yes. It's a difficult nut to crack, I guess. I think you find that the fellows coming back from 9/11 and forward, which are the ones that we serve for the most part, but we have had occasion to help others from wars before that. But they went to come back and they went to work with, pardon me?
I'm sorry, go ahead, I'm sorry.
They're looking to work with other veterans who know what they've been through. And what the wars that they're coming back from now are not like the wars that we've fought before. But then, go ahead. We have one fellow who's in our group who is a World War II veteran, and I think when he first came home, his story is that his dad basically said, get up, go to work, it's in the past, you're done. But now, since he's been working with our group, there have been many times that, in a sense, that's been a healing for him because he's been able to get some of that out.
It's quite amazing to see this young fella is in his 90s, and he's very active, and he is. To hear him describe, you know, he was the grunt in the army. You know, he did what he was told, dug the ditch when he was told, and a big brute of a guy. But he absolutely just melts when he's talking to a vet. And his terminology was and that was the story he told the day, you know, he came home on a Thursday, and he says, "Yeah, the old man told me to take Friday and Saturday off and be to work on Monday." And that was the mindset then. You won't go back into your history. You won't find PTSD mentioned in WW1, WW2. Okay, at the time it was shell shock. But as this has progressed, it is a problem. And it goes back to what you, the young men coming back, okay, are not actively seeking outside help. It's a chore. But I think it goes back to one of the things that Shane said. We've got to be there and be ready when it happens. I tell you this, when we came back and started it with our church, we had a little thing here and a little thing there, and we sent 100 packages at Christmas time over. But we met once a month, and faithfully once a month. And I will tell you this: we were fortunate. We got some seed money, and our first fundraiser was pretty decent. We went for 2 years without a sentinel. We had called them scholarships, and we would offer the scholarship. We went, and I will tell you this: once a month for 2 years. When we had our monthly meetings, we would pray for guidance. We prayed that God would send us a sentinel, someone that we could help. And it was 2 years. Okay, like I said, we had little things here, little things there, but it was 2 years before we got Iraq or Iran. A person that had served there. And it was a very unique situation that we got involved on that one. This was, as I had alluded to, there were 52, let's call them chapters, set up. And this soldier happened to be a female soldier from Louisiana. And no one would take her. She was from Fort Carson in Colorado. There were 3 chapters in Colorado. They didn't want to get involved. And it came to us because we, out of the 52 or the 50-some chapters, we were the only faith-based chapter. Everything else was business, you know, with a shirt and a tie. But that's how we got involved on our very, very first Sentinel. And since then, like I say, we've had some true blessings. And there I will tell you this: if you do get involved in something like this, there will be heartaches. It comes with the territory.
But some of the accomplishments that we have had, some of the joys, are that we've been able to provide a rental unit for a certain length of time for some of these vets. We've been able to furnish their homes. We've been able to help them find child care, help them get established in a community college or a church or in their community. We've been able to provide Meals on Wheels. We've been able to help some families of the returning veterans. The veterans themselves didn't want to seek help, but their families really needed help. And so their wives came and said, for some reason the insurance is done for a month. We're in the midst of the process, but my son is running a fever of 103. So we said, take him to the hospital. We will pay the bill. And we've had a couple of wives come and need repairs done on the furniture or on their houses. And we've done that. We had a gal come and needed a furnace. So we did that. There's an awful lot of need out there, and there are an awful lot of charitable organizations, but 1% of our population protects the rest of us. And we owe them our support. But I think our time is up.
Our time is up. And let me part with this by saying that one of the big pluses of having it local as opposed to a national, where they do good work, but they have X amount of expense. Okay, here the money will make it back, and you can control it. Like she was saying, even though we were set up to help specifically a soldier or a sailor or a marine. Okay, if the family, you know, that family problem came from the war. She was not over there. The kids were not over there. But that problem came from there. And we had the flexibility to go in and cure it. So I did not mean to run over.
No, that's the problem.
So back to you, my friend.
I'll talk into this to make sure it gets on the recording. So now it's my pleasure to introduce you to Bishop Chaplain. I always want to say Chaplain Bishop, but in some order of honorarias, Bishop Chaplain Alan Morris, who is the full-time palliative and hospice chaplain for the VA Pittsburgh Medical System, or health system. He's been serving there since 2008. And in that role, he supervises the pastoral care of veterans with palliative and hospice consults. Last year, he served 1,330 consults. That's 5.5 new end-of-life consults per working day. He doesn't do this all by himself. He has the assistance of 2 full-time chaplain residents, as well as chaplain interns, and a hospice volunteer program of 30 volunteers for hospice and another more than 50 volunteers for the No Veteran Dies Alone program. That's a program that was featured in a WTAE news segment back in 2014. In addition to his ministry at the VA, Alan serves as a bishop in the Convocation of Anglicans in North America, abbreviated CANA, in the province of Nigeria, and he's endorsed by the Special Jurisdiction for Armed Forces and Chaplaincy of the Anglican Church of North America, of which he is the bishop in residence and the bishop protector of the Order of St. Martin of Tours. He's licensed right here in the Anglican Diocese of Pittsburgh, ACNA. And his wife, who is a deacon, April Morris, is also with us today, too. So we're delighted to have the Morris family here to bring their wisdom around serving veterans. Thank you so much.
I'm going to get this stand. I brought some bibliography information. So, I'm sorry. Okay, great. Just some of the research that's going on. We're going to talk today about moral injury. Moral injury is a discussion that we're beginning to have on many levels. If you go online and you just type in moral injury, you'll get all kinds of returns because there's lots and lots of research being done. The reason so much effort is going into the discussion on moral injury is because of the magnitude of the problem. PTSD was one thing, and we all understand PTSD. We understand the symptoms of PTSD, right? Startle reflex and memory loss and nightmares, fear and anxiety. And it goes on and on. Anger, depression, insomnia, and a lot of self-medication. Moral injury is all of that, and a few things more. With moral injury, you're going to get sometimes deep sorrow, deep sense of grief, regret, shame, and a sense of alienation, in addition to the symptoms of PTSD. I've had the pleasure, I guess, of sitting in two lectures given by a fellow by the name of Bill Nash. Dr. Bill Nash is the head of psychiatry for the Marines. And his office is in the Pentagon. He's doing a lot of research, and of course he has the data. He has the subject material. What Bill Nash tells me is that of the roughly 2 million soldiers we have had fighting OEF, OIF, and OND, so that's Iraq twice and Afghanistan, of those 2 million soldiers, 80% are returning to us morally injured. PTSD is a different kind of thing than moral injury. PTSD is an event-based injury. Right? Something happened. And so in the therapeutic treatments for PTSD, we can go back and we can make reference to this problem, this thing that happened, that created this PTSD. Not so with moral injury. Moral injury is a different animal. For one thing, we are coming to the conclusion now that this is indeed a spiritual injury. Moral injury is an injury not event-based, but it is experience-based. It is experience-based. So what that means is it's an injury to the fabric of a person's life. Let me give you just a basic scenario of moral injury. And let me say, this is a really difficult talk for me to give. In the VA, we're kind of charged with the responsibility of picking up the pieces. In palliative hospice, and you mentioned you must do hospice or end-of-life work of some kind. Okay? At end-of-life, like you said, PTSD manifests itself. Moral injury is doing the same thing. And we're figuring out that moral injury isn't a new thing. It's what we have always been dealing. If you get a chance, go to the website for Huffington Post and look up David Wood on moral injury. David Wood is one of those correspondents who would embed. And he had done that in combat situations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he'd done it for 25 years in one conflict and another conflict. But he was baffled. Some would come back, and you could see that they were injured, and they were diagnosed with PTSD. Okay? But many of the guys came back and they were injured undiagnosedly. And yet they were hurt and they were suffering. And he kind of led the charge originally, several years ago, on moral injury. He wrote 3 or 4 articles there you can find in the Huffington Post. They're wonderful descriptions of what it actually is. And I was going to say, this is a very hard talk for me to give because I'm face to face with this all day long, every day. You talk about heartbreak. Yeah. You know, doing this kind of work, working with these kinds of injuries, takes personal care to a whole new level. So, moral injury is an event-based injury. And here's the basic scenario. You take a child, 17 or 18 years old, and they are children. Make no mistake, these are children. Who was raised in southwestern Pennsylvania, which is a very religious place. But we share together a set of common values, right? First of all, humanity itself, in general, believes that killing is bad. Right? That's a basic premise all the way through culture. We have that value. We have grown up in a very Christian environment. When I look at the face sheets on all of the veterans that I serve, there's a place in there for religious preference. You know, about 98.5% of them have a Christian heritage. That means they were raised with what we understand to be a common set of values. Right? So if you go punch Johnny in the nose on the school ground, what's going to happen? Right? You're going to get suspended from school. You're going to get brought in. You might get a spanking when you get home. You might get grounded. That's because that's bad behavior. On the other hand, if you get an A on your English paper, you're going to get patted on the head, and that's good behavior. We have a very distinct understanding of what good is and what bad is. And there's lots of other Christian values that are built into this, and we share them together. So, you take this 18-year-old child, he joins the Marines or the Army or whatever, and you teach him to kill. There's an excellent book written by, and it's in the bibliography, by a Lieutenant Dave Grossman called On Killing. One of the most fascinating chapters in that book is, it's called Overcoming the Reluctance to Kill. Overcoming the Reluctance to Kill. How that is done. How that is accomplished. Because it must be overcome if you're going to go fight. You must kill. You take this 18-year-old child who grew up in a set of Christian values. He understood very clearly what was good and what was bad. He knows if he punched Johnny in the nose, that was bad. And killing is bad. This is an odd Christian culture we live in America. How is it that we are the followers of the Prince of Peace, and yet the church is the first one to stand in line to be proud of its Christian youth going to war? Why is that? I'm not going to try and answer that. It's food for thought. So you take this child and you teach them to kill. And in fact, you send them to war and they do kill. And then they come, you bring them back. You know, you were asking a minute ago, they're not coming. They're not coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. And they're not coming to what we offer. There's good reason for this. And a big part of it is called moral injury. How many times have you heard an interview on the TV or on the radio where the wife or the mother is saying, "We just don't understand. He is not the same person he was when he went away." The divorce rate among people with moral injury is very high. We've got a high military suicide rates. A good friend of mine who was an Army chaplain, Bronze Star for valor and all of that stuff, sand in his boots, fought in Iraq, was in charge of a company or a battalion, I don't know how that works, battalion. He had 8 suicides in his battalion while they were on active duty. So they made him part of a panel discussion. How do we stop the suicides? He explains to me that in the military, if you have suicides among your troops and you are the chaplain, they look at you as the responsible party. You explain this. All participated in their panel discussion and all. But at one point he said, "Do you really want to stop the suicides?" "Yeah, we want to stop this." There is only one way. Stop making war. These kids come back changed. And everyone is so surprised. But the truth is, it's impossible that they not be changed. It is the very fabric of their lives that is being changed. So you bring them back and you put them back into culture and back into society. And that's another question, isn't it? What is the impact of 80% of 2 million of our kids coming back morally injured and unable to function as members of the society and the culture we have? What we have done, when a child is raised with these values that I've been talking about, and you teach them to kill, and you send them to war, and that they do kill, and in fact, their reward while they are at war is based on their effectiveness at it. Right? So you get medals. You get promotions. You are rewarded for what you are doing. Now you bring that child back into this culture. And what we see over and over again, "We're so proud of you." And you pat them on the back. And you bring them in your church and you make them stand up on Veterans Day. I, for one, am one of those veterans who will not stay. Not because I don't value the people, but because they don't understand. They just don't understand. You bring them back and you pat them on the back, and that veteran is saying, "Now, wait a minute. Excuse me? If I did here what I have been doing for the last year, you would put a needle in my arm. And you're telling me you're proud of me." You're telling me you're proud of me. What that does to a child is you have inverted their whole value system. Good has now become not as good. And that has become what you're rewarded and what they're proud of you for. And you bring them back into culture in that way. And what are they to do? You have set up a moral conflict that cannot be resolved. They don't come to the groups. How are they to resolve this? 80% coming back. Stop there and see if there's a see you have a soldier.
don't want to be recorded for legal purposes or something. Yeah, right, that guy. Anyway, born and raised Butler, Pennsylvania, commissioned through IUPRTC as an infantry lieutenant, did all the high-speed stuff, ranger school, airborne school, checked all the blocks, expected as a ranger, infantry lieutenant, went off to Korea, did time there, then I went to Iraq, Afghanistan, was a company commander in Afghanistan. That's where you're in charge of 150 soldiers, combat soldiers, on an outpost in the mountains of Afghanistan, doing combat patrols, dealing with the people and everything else. Did that for 10 years and decided I want to serve soldiers in a different way. And came back to the National Guard part-time, Army, living in Butler, working part-time. And I'm a chaplain candidate, Liberty University Seminarian. Hopefully, with God's grace and will, I will be assessed as a full chaplain so I get rid of these goofy little whatever they are. It's a nondescript book, some leaves, and a shepherd's crook, or beaten stick, as some soldiers call it. And then I'll become a chaplain of the cross and do stuff. I'm in a unique position because I've been on both sides of the fence now as a somewhat spiritual leader, as trying to become that spiritual leader for people, which sometimes as you become a spiritual leader, you find out a lot about yourself and others. But I've been in combat, shot at, and done all this stuff that you consider combat. Now, and this is where I think I say this is hitting the nail on the head. I was an officer. If you're familiar with the way the Army works, officers aren't doers, they're orderers. I was in multiple firefights, but didn't get to shoot anybody. And some people say, oh, that's bad, you didn't do your job. My weapon system was a radio. My weapon system was to say, what are you doing? Move here, do this, get there. We can't do it, well, you better do it. Hurry up, get here. My position, though, was in the middle. And what that lends itself to, and why I say this moral, I've been shot at. I've never really, I mean, we could talk about how getting shot at kind of affects you. It really didn't affect me that much. I mean, I came some close calls. It wasn't as much as some, more than others. You know, I'm not trying to level people's experience with these things. But that wasn't where the pain come from. I have no PTSD. I didn't, but I still came home agitated. I had a hairpin trigger with my kids, you know. They'd cough long, and I'd be on them. And I'd said, something happened. And I've kind of asked the question, what? And I think it boils down to, when you're the middle person, sometimes you have to take this guy who is your boss saying, you will do this. Reality is, it just can't be done. And turn around and tell people you will do this. To the point of, hey, you will go do this, and you may not come back, but figure it out, and I told you to do it. And personally, I don't even care if you do it, but guess what? In the system I'm in. And I realize a lot of the stress that I've come home with is being in a situation where I was stuck in the middle. It wasn't from the combat itself. It was dealing with the situations I wasn't fully understanding, I wasn't fully, you know, grasping, and I think that's why I say for the first time I've ever heard anybody call it moral injury, and I think there's something to this. I'm learning as this is the second time I've got to sit in an experience, but it's something that I wouldn't say I have a PTSD from a traumatic event. I've never had to get into hand-to-hand combat. You know, I've read Grossman's book. He has two of them. Great reads on if you're trying to understand the psyche and mentality of the soldier. Then he ends up with what are we doing with our kids in video games, which is another discussion. I can see that, but I've personally never had to take a blunt object to another person. And so I'm not saying I have a PTSD in that way. But I will tell you that I've had my own struggles. I will say they're mild comparatively. I'd love to learn more and be involved in any discussions or other stuff. And just kind of, if not anybody else wants it, get my experience, whatever it is, because I don't want to take it as time to get through these and turn this into session. I think there's something to it. I see that as well.
Thanks for that. That was invaluable to the discussion. Moral injury, we are realizing, is a deeply spiritual injury. It's an injury to the very fabric of the person's life. It's irreconcilable conflict. It is alienating. I remember there was a World War II veteran that I got to know through palliative hospice. I knew him an outpatient. He didn't talk much. I knew he didn't have any friends. He was an artist. And he lived over in Ohio. And it turns out he was a hermit artist. He was dying of cancer. And the times that I saw him, and like I said, he didn't talk much, was in outpatient clinic. The last time that I saw him, the doctor who directs our program and myself were in visiting him for the last time. We said our goodbyes and turned to the door. And he said, Chaplain, can you wait a minute? And so, of course, I pulled up a chair. And he says, you know, ever since I came back from the war in the Pacific, I've lived my life as a hermit. Never reconnected with my family. Never saw my friends again. And he said, it just doesn't seem right to me. But now I should die and no one will die. So, for an hour, I listened to his story. This is just one story. He enlisted when he was 17. The war in the Pacific was on. He enlisted in the Marines. And he participated in every major beach landing from Chihuahua to Okinawa. He made it out alive. Somewhere along the way, now this was a boy that was raised in a Christian family. Somewhere along the way, he came to the realization that there could be no such thing as a good God. Not possible. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And a little further along the way, he swore to himself, because he had no God anymore, that he would never be responsible for bringing a child into a world like this one. And so he lived his life up to God. He did die 2 weeks later. You know what he wanted from me? It was God's blessing. But you got it. The stories go on and on. And we realize more and more what we're actually looking for. The more never again to bring their lives back to them. So there's not only a lot of research going on, but there is, in addition to that research, suggestions coming out, propositions, open, effective therapies. How are we? How do you deal with? And in particular, if they won't even come. Well, you spent 2 years trying to get them to come. The degree of alienation and self-loathing, the inability to reconcile, we're so proud of you, the inability to reconcile, I'm a good person and I've done awful things. Where's the help? I want to suggest, you know, I had a group of pastors come to visit me. They come every once in a while. I don't even know what they can do. Came to me and they want to start a program for veterans in our church. Great. We got a model. Well, we don't know. We're thinking maybe a small group. Good. How many veterans you got in your congregation? Well, how many veterans do you know? You don't know. And I said, you know what? Until you have come to love a veteran, whatever it is you're selling, they don't need. The one thing that they need, you are not offering. Jesus is talking to the guys. He comes to this point and he says, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends. Friends is the highest order of relationship with Jesus. That is the highest order of relationship. And when you think about relationship, this is the very fabric of our lives. When you get to the end of your life, the only thing you have left is your relationships. Everything else is going away. Someone suffering moral injury, the one thing that they need more than anything else that you can do for them is the action that you can take. Trust among the morally injured is hard to come by. But the one thing that I can take that will be healed is the extension of actual relationship that eventually and by virtue of that trust relationship, then you can hear the stories. I sent those pastors home with these words of encouragement. Until you have come to love a veteran, don't bother. That's what Shane was talking about this morning, right? The key to reaching this generation is an actual relationship. Paul told at the panel, talking about how to stop the suicides. Stop making war. And when I've got to this point in the talk, sometimes before, people say, how do we do that? In a world like this, how can we stop the war? I offer this solution. When the world had done all of the evil that it possibly could to Jesus, what was God's response to the evil that was done to the Son of God? Father, forgive them. They believe. Is it really for Christians so far-fetched that when insulted as a nation, we can say,
Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Forgiveness is, in fact, the only viable option for Christians. Faith remains about the teaching of the Prince of Peace. Wherever did he teach an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? Not even once. What Jesus did teach was enemy love. How are we to respond to those who offend us and call ourselves Christian? It is the viable alternative to it. And I started out this talk. Isn't it odd that the church in America is the first one to stand in line and endorse sending their children to war at the first sign of offense? Isn't that an odd thing? It's a ridiculous conversation. We can't actually call ourselves Christian. It is antichrist. So let's stop here. Any thoughts?
One of the things that seems to be healing through is that he believes that although there were awkwardness, that it was like the first official thing of like a war without being called a war, it was like the beginning of, if you will, the end of organization among conflicts, I guess, but he speaks of it as helpful to the people of South Korea. So I think the dilemma is a question, too, about keeping people safe, thinking of how we can look to maximize peace and diplomacy in the sense of also not letting another person be a victim of another person's oppression. I think that's part of the dilemma. The second thing, I think, whenever we're dealing with a person who's suffering, the soldier, veteran, we're in a different place, a little bit of a different place than the discussion about overarching shared desire that we not have any unnecessary conflict of any kind at any level. Yes, but where we meet them, it seems to me, is some way to help them understand that by their doing what was expected of them, but it's similar maybe to a police officer who has to protect an innocent person and put his own or her own life in jeopardy, or perhaps fatally wound a perpetrator. I think it's important to kind of nuance the discussion around in those times of suffering that they're enduring, that it's not just all senseless. That there's a process, and we very well may sometimes feel leaking around. But I think there's also some hope that we can bring into the discussion with a friend, like their counselor walking with them, that they weren't doing something black and white, pure evil, that they were in their hearts more than injured because they struggle. And I don't think that's a good thing. It just maybe inspires some conversation.
One of the things that you said, I'm very good friends. So there is a little bit, there is a nuance. And I would like to stress that this isn't a dualistic. We don't want to be dualistic. Because, of course, we want to do the best of the best. And so I was a child of the 60s, participating in anti-war activities, all that stuff. But now I'm putting back into that place of loving veterans. You know, most of my veterans hate war. I mean, most veterans hate war. Like you, whom young people see, none of them are going to come up and say war is good. And most of them will say that it was very harmful to them. You see my perennial veteran say, war is hell. We've got to stop having war. And so, you know, you look at all the nuances, like you say, and then we start to understand that what is at stake here is loving the veteran. So that they will come out more whole. So that they will understand that, no, we're not placing judgment on them just because we hate war. They are our friends, and what we want for them to be people. So it is you.
Question about just war, a necessary war, is one that you can approach a whole lot of ways. James talking about guns this morning. We live in a violent nation, and we need to accept responsibility. You guys are the pastors. We, as pastors, have to step to the front and reach out. There is no good answer at this place how we should be. But we have to take a stand, I believe, alongside of Jesus and reject violence. It's a problem that begins with each of us. We each must take a stand against violence, for violence to ever end. And yes, we've got a violent world. And we all know that. We have no place in agreement with the gospel. We will be in abortion. Can we answer that question? Korean people are very grateful. You know, a few years ago they published a book honoring. It begins with each one of us personally rejecting violence. I'm reminded of the scene in the Tolkien's trilogy. We've all seen it. Down towards the end of the Two Towers, we have Sam and Frodo struggling all the time. Frodo turns to Sam and says, "Why are you doing this?" And that you can see the speed going on and say, "Why are you doing this? Because it's true. Yes, there is evil in you. There is good also. And it is. We as Christians reject violence and we fight. We are the heathens. We won't be the heathens.
beginning of the age bracket of those in the first conflict. I think it started my freshman year of college, so a lot of my friends are acquaintances are people who have served. I probably know more people with PTSD than I know have PTSD now, so I figured out they would. But how, as someone who's not served and cannot imagine what they went through, how can we reach out to them in a professional way and listen to them today? Is it affirming at the same time, how is it their aspect, their structure?